Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Katrina Perry from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at Brazil's unending flood. One of its richest cities, Porto Alegre, is still struggling with floodwaters that rushed in more than a month ago. It's been a national shock. Officials are still looking for bodies and warning of the spread of disease. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 11th of June, these are our main stories. The United Nations Security Council has voted in favour of an American resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire by Israel and Hamas in Gaza. An aircraft carrying Malawi's vice president has gone missing. Poland says it's planning to reintroduce a no-go zone on its border with Belarus days after a Polish soldier was stabbed to death. Also in this podcast,
we could see phones creeping in actually with 9-year-olds and 10-year-olds, you know, and the children started going on WhatsApps, you know, and we were as teachers dealing with kids being left out or kids being upset.
We hear from the teachers of the primary schools in one Irish town that are asking parents to delay buying their children smartphones because of fears they may bring on anxiety. We begin at the United Nations Security Council in New York.
Will those in favour of the draft resolution please raise their hand? Those against? Abstentions? The result of the voting is as follows. 14 votes in favour, 0 votes against, 1 abstention. The draft resolution has been adopted as Resolution 2735.
Could this be the vote that brings a ceasefire in the war in Gaza closer? The resolution proposed by the United States called for an immediate, full and complete ceasefire by Israel and Hamas. Russia abstained. Speaking after the vote, the US ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, said the fighting in Gaza could end now if Hamas accepted the three-phase plan. Earlier, she called on both sides to implement the deal without delay and without condition. The ambassador said all sides would benefit.
This deal would bring hostages home, ensure Israel's security, enable a surge of humanitarian relief and essential services, including water and electricity, medical facilities and rubble removal to Palestinian civilians in Gaza.
Within minutes of the vote, Hamas issued a statement saying it welcomed it. And the Palestinian ambassador to the UN, Riyad Mansour, had this to say.
The Palestinian leadership welcomed this effort, this step in the right direction, and emphasized that, of course, our position has been always to have an immediate ceasefire to stop the killing of our people. So this resolution is a step in that direction.
The vote came after Washington's top diplomat, Antony Blinken, held talks in Israel with the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. I spoke to our North America correspondent, Neda Torfik, who's at the UN, and asked her what this resolution proposes.
This resolution essentially endorses the deal that was proposed by President Biden 10 days ago, and it outlines in the resolution the three phases that the United States outlined. The first, to get an immediate ceasefire, to get the hostages released, the women, the elderly, the wounded, in exchange for Palestinian prisoners, and then to have the withdrawal of Israeli forces from populated areas in Gaza and to have more aid going in. Eventually, they say that would lead to phase two and three, where you would see major reconstruction of Gaza, the full withdrawal of all forces. And they make the point that if phase one goes beyond kind of the 6 weeks needed, that a ceasefire will remain in place as long as negotiations do. And the resolution also rejects any changes to Gaza's territorial size and integrity. So laying out the parameters, the framework for a deal in this resolution.
Hamas is said to have put out a statement saying it welcomes the resolution. There's a lot of pressure on Hamas to accept it, isn't there?
That's right. I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence that this resolution passed at the same time that Antony Blinken is on his eighth visit to the region. The United States says they've been working around the clock with Qatar and Egypt to reach a deal. And what we're hearing publicly from the United States is that this is an Israeli initiative, this proposal. They've already accepted it. So the pressure needs to be on Hamas. And they wanted this resolution to put pressure on Hamas. Now, what we've heard, though, from Russia, China, others, is some skepticism that Israel has accepted this deal. They point to some of the statements made by Israeli officials that this war is going to continue until they defeat Hamas. They see statements coming from far-right ministers that are threatening to collapse the government if it's implemented. And so even though this resolution did pass, Russia ultimately abstained because the Arab group was on board and wanted this. But they did note that there seems to be, you know, a bit of a difference between what the U.S. is saying publicly and what Israel really feels about this deal.
Well, and that's the thing, isn't there? Is there going to be a complete ceasefire, which Hamas has said is always absolutely essential, or isn't there? Because Israel has been clear it's not stopping until it's, as it sees it, defeated Hamas.
Yeah, and I think, look, China in their statement noted that the other previous Security Council resolutions, the last three, haven't been implemented, calling for a ceasefire during the month of Ramadan, calling for more aid to go in. So the question is, you know, will this time be any different? I think while getting resolutions is useful in terms of pressure on the parties, I think the real test is, of course, going to be what Antony Blinken is able to achieve. I mean, time is obviously kind of running out. They're trying to get something done before the U.S. presidential election in November. Israeli politics have certainly made this deal more fragile. Hamas hasn't responded with a counterproposal to the United States on the deal on the table yet, even though it's welcomed this resolution. So a lot in flux.
Neda Torfik. The leader of Malawi says he's ordered the search and rescue operation for his vice president, Saulos Chilima, to continue until the aircraft carrying him and nine others is found. President Lazarus Chakwera said no effort would be spared and has cancelled a scheduled trip abroad. The military aircraft is thought to have come down in bad weather on Monday morning, shortly after being turned away from an airport in Mazuzu because of poor visibility. The passengers on board were due to attend the funeral of a former justice minister. Our reporter Shingai Nyoka gave us this update from Zimbabwe.
Well, a statement that was released earlier said that the vice president, as well as nine others, were aboard a Malawi Defense Force aircraft that left Lilongwe, which is the capital of Malawi, at about 9:15 local time, and was headed north. And it was supposed to arrive about 45 minutes after it departed. But then at some point, the aircraft went off radar and they have failed to locate it. And so that search has been underway for many hours now, conducted by various agencies. They didn't really say where they suspect that this aircraft might have gone down. But local media reports say that it might, that the search has been concentrated around a particular forest just north of the capital. Unofficially, through the reports on social media as well as through local media, it seems to be an assumption that his plane might have crashed. We still also don't have details about who else was on board. We understand that he was on government business. This is according to a minister who confirmed that to the BBC, that he was on his way to a funeral in Mazuzu in the northern part of the country.
Shingai Nyoka. Political parties in France are racing to field candidates and discuss possible alliances after President Emmanuel Macron called an early parliamentary election. The decision was made following his party's defeat in the European elections, in which the far-right National Rally secured an overwhelming victory. The socialist mayor of Paris, Anne Hidalgo, said holding another vote so close to the Olympic Games was unsettling. Our correspondent in Paris, Hugh Schofield, has been gauging reaction.
Coulommiers, 30 miles east of the capital, is where Paris ends and the provinces begin. More than a third of voters here chose Jordan Bardella and the National Rally. Why? Because they say their concerns are routinely ignored by the powers that be. Concerns, says Josiane, like immigration and insecurity.
40 years ago, this was a nice place. Nobody was aggressive. You could go out at night for a stroll. But now we are afraid. I'm just coming back from the post office, and I'm sorry to say, but everyone there was in Arab dress.
In 3 weeks, everyone will be voting again, this time not for distant MEPs, but for national lawmakers. Everyone agrees it was a massive gamble by President Macron to call early elections. He may be hoping that the National Rally can't possibly replicate its European triumph, but he can't possibly be sure. One theory is that he wants to let the far right into power in order to see it fail. But that, says Pascal Perrineau of the Sciences Po School of Political Science, is also a gamble.
Macron peut espérer peut-être l'usure.
President Macron may be betting that the National Rally isn't ready for government and that in the end it will all turn out badly for them. But will that necessarily be the case? In lots of countries in the EU, the far right is in government and life goes on. So I think, if that is his bet, it's a very risky one.
This evening, the political parties in France are scrambling to prepare for this sudden electoral consultation. The left is calling, without much hope, for a united front to block the National Rally. The president knows it's his own future as well as the country's that is at stake.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. In the wake of the right-wing gains in some European countries, Germany's Chancellor Olaf Scholz has described the results as worrying, adding, one should not get used to it. The President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, insisted the political centre was holding. Our Europe editor, Katja Adler, has this assessment of what the results mean for the future direction of European politics.
The hard right just won big across Europe, and notably inside the EU's power couple France and Germany. What does this mean? The winds in Europe are definitely blowing rightwards, dominated by mainstream conservatives, with a question around how much they'll work with parties on the harder right. Clues can be found by following the fortunes of three high-profile female politicians. Ursula von der Leyen is the president of the European Commission, campaigning for a second term. She's one of many on the centre-right who now ape the language of the hard right on issues like migration. She hopes to broaden her appeal, and she's allied herself with Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, an example of former far-right figures moderating their image to attract the mainstream. When Ms. Meloni once openly praised Benito Mussolini, her country's 20th century fascist dictator, she now cites Margaret Thatcher as her muse. She's become a kingmaker on the European stage, courted by the centre-right and those on the far-right, like France's Marine Le Pen. She's still viewed in Brussels as an extreme right disruptor, but she's hoping French voters in their snap election this summer will show her politics are the future.
Katja Adler. 1 year ago, the head teachers at all the primary schools in the Irish town of Greystones got together. Concerned by increasing levels of anxiety among their pupils, they asked parents to sign a voluntary pledge or code to delay buying smartphones for their children until at least the start of secondary school, which in Ireland is at age 12. Beth MacLeod has been to the town to see how the initiative has been received by parents and pupils.
Good morning. Hi, Mabel.
At the gates of St. Patrick's Primary School, groups of children in blue uniform waved goodbye to their parents and hello to their head teacher, Rachel Harper. The children here are getting used to visits from reporters. The school has been on the news in Canada, the US, India, France, Spain for a trailblazing initiative that taps into a heated global debate, whether smartphones are damaging young people's mental health.
We could see phones creeping in, actually, in a very small way with 9-year-olds and 10-year-olds, you know. And I suppose with that came then the children started going on WhatsApps, you know, and we were, as teachers, dealing with kids being left out or kids being upset.
A recent major survey found that by the time they leave primary school, nearly three-quarters of children in Ireland have their own smartphone,
And a smaller poll found that a quarter of six-year-olds do.
We find, and as a group of principals, that they were just growing up so quickly. We find like we would have had second class going swimming and what they would be around the age of 8 and 9, and already they were very body conscious. You wouldn't let your child open the door to a room full of strangers and leave them in that room on their own. And unfortunately, that is what's happening when they have a smart device.
Rachel Harper says that before the code was introduced, nearly all the pupils in their final year had a smartphone. Now, only a handful do. This 9-year-old pupil is also called Rachel.
I haven't really heard anyone from, like, our class or anywhere younger saying they want a phone.
So do you feel like you're missing out on anything by being at a school where smartphones are discouraged?
Actually not, because you're missing out on something when the whole school has it. When no one in this county has it, that means you're not missing out on anything.
Most tech companies offer parental controls on their apps, and Meta says it's responded to criticism by putting new policies in place to protect young people.
I really want to emphasise we're not against technology. We know that technology is a huge part in the modern world and also in children's education. So we feel, look, if they have online time at home, that it should be monitored, that it's a family iPad that they're using, that parents can just keep checking in.
At home time, children pour out of classrooms. Most of the parents I speak to say they feel relieved they don't have to choose between giving their child a smartphone or leaving them socially isolated.
Now that we've got video games in our house, the idea of my 10-year-old having a phone is absolutely terrifying. So the longer we can fend that off, the better. And to be honest, since the policy has been brought into the school, the children themselves don't even want to have phones, so that conversation hasn't arisen for us, which has been amazing.
By coming together as a community, the town seems to have created a culture shift. But it's still the norm to get a smartphone at the start of secondary school. Some question if that's also too young.
We are getting much more referrals into mental health services. We're getting much more referrals into emergency departments.
Stephen Donnelly, the Irish Health Minister, who also happens to be a Greystones parent, thinks the initiative is a great way to reduce some of the harm he says is being done to young people. And according to him, governments are starting to force tech companies to do more.
For them to have a long-term business, they need a long-term business that is not linked to children killing themselves. The best thing that they can do is make sure that they're heavily regulated, fully transparent, that they bring in proper age verification. What I would do is move the age to 16. And I would have age.
Well, WhatsApp's just moved the age down from 16 to 13, hasn't it?
Right.
In the EU and UK. So they seem to be going the opposite direction.
Yeah, I would move it to 16.
Do you think there's any sign that that would happen?
We've an important moment in time now to work together. And I think we will look back at the last 5 or 10 years in time with horror. I think we will look back and say this was the Wild West.
The Irish Health Minister, Stephen Donnelly, ending that report from Beth McLeod. And you can hear more in this week's edition of Assignment on the BBC World Service. Still to come, the prospect of a single vaccination for both COVID and flu.
You get one dose, one needle versus two needles. I don't think a lot of people lack needles, so that would be helpful.
This is the Global News Podcast. Poland says it's planning to reintroduce a no-go zone on its border with Belarus on Thursday following the death of a Polish soldier who was stabbed by a migrant. The Poland-Belarus border has become a flashpoint since migrants started arriving there in large numbers in 2021. Adam Easton reports from Warsaw.
Prime Minister Donald Tusk said the no-go zone would make it more difficult for migrants to cross into Poland from Belarus illegally by creating more secure conditions for border guards, police and soldiers to work in. Rights groups have criticised the plan, saying the services will be able to push back migrants and asylum seekers without oversight. A no-go zone was originally introduced after a huge increase in migrant crossings started 3 years ago. It was abolished after a 5.5-metre-tall steel pole border fence was erected. Despite the fence, crossing attempts have surged in recent weeks.
Adam Easton. In a Spanish court case that has been described as victory for the fight against racism in the country, three football fans have been sentenced to 8 months in prison for racist abuse at a football match in May last year. Three Valencia fans were convicted for racially abusing Vinicius Jr., who plays for Real Madrid. The guilty fans have also been banned from entering any football stadium in Spain for 2 years. It's the first conviction for racism-related cases in professional football in the country. Susanna Gisbert, the prosecutor in the case, spoke to the media outside a court in Valencia.
People should know that this type of act is punishable. It is punishable as a hate crime because the sentence is for moral integrity with the aggravating factor of hate. And it is also very important that one of the factors taken into account for the suspension of the sentence is the fact of repentance and a letter of public apology, as well as being banned from football stadiums where matches are held.
Vinicius Jr., who is black, has suffered ongoing racist abuse. Our reporter Guy Hedgeco sent this report from Madrid.
Vinicius Jr. was playing for Real Madrid in a league game in Valencia's stadium when a group of opposition fans shouted racist insults and made monkey noises at him. The game came to a halt as the player ran to the sideline and confronted them. The three men prosecuted have been given 8 month sentences, although they are unlikely to serve jail time because it's a short sentence for a non-violent crime. They've also been banned from attending top-tier games for 2 years and have written an apology to Vinicius Jr. The incident triggered a major debate about racism in Spanish football and even caused diplomatic tensions with Brazil. The president of the Spanish Football League, Javier Tebas, welcomed the court's decision, calling it great news for the fight against racism in Spain.
Guy Hedgeco. New research in Singapore suggests there could have been 135 million premature deaths caused by one kind of pollution, fine particles in the air, over a 40-year period. The researchers believe more than half of those deaths were in China and India. Our Asia-Pacific regional editor Mickey Bristow reports.
The World Health Organization has already told us that millions of people die each year from fine particles in the air. These are caused by vehicle emissions, industrial processes, wildfires and dust storms, also by households that use open fires. But the researchers from Singapore have put a number on those who they estimate have died because of this pollution, 135 million between 1980 and 2020. And these are premature deaths, people who died earlier than expected by something that was preventable.
Mickey Bristow. The American biotech company Moderna says it's developed a combined flu and COVID vaccine which targets both diseases as effectively as separate injections. Here's our medical editor, Fergus Walsh.
8,000 volunteers aged over 50 took part in the trial, which measured antibody levels after vaccination. The results showed Moderna's combined COVID and flu vaccine produced immune responses which were at least as good as having similar jabs separately. Side effects from the combined vaccine were generally mild. Moderna's chief executive, Stefan Bancel, told the BBC it would spare people the need for two injections and boost vaccine coverage.
You get one dose, one needle, versus two needles. I don't think a lot of people lack needles, so that would be helpful. The highest value from a public health standpoint is ensuring everybody gets protected.
The two-in-one vaccine uses the same messenger RNA technology as found in current COVID jabs. The mRNA instructs the body to make proteins found in the COVID and flu viruses, which then prompts an immune response. Moderna's competitors, Pfizer and BioNTech, are also testing a similar dual shot. Subject to approval by licensing bodies, it seems likely that in years to come, adults may be offered a combined jab.
Fergus Walsh. Wildfires are raging across the world's largest tropical wetland, the Pantanal, in Brazil. Local media are reporting that more than 30,000 hectares have already been destroyed. According to climate experts, the wildfire season has started earlier than normal. Paul Henley spoke to Arno Desbier, the president of the Wild Animal Conservation Institute, a Brazilian charity who has been working on the Pantanal for more than 20 years.
The season of fires has started very early.
Normally, at this time of the year, June, the Pantanal should still be with large expanses flooded. However, this year we have not had a wet season, and so the fires have started really early. And I'm just looking at some numbers here. This year, between the 1st of January to the 7th of June, we have already had 1,193 fires. And in the same period last year, we had 106 fires. So as you can see, this year there is a dramatic increase in the number of fires.
Can you paint a picture of this region? It's an important wildlife habitat, isn't it?
Well, yes. Well, in fact, in Portuguese, Pantanal means swamp. So what I should normally be describing to you is a mosaic environment of pockets of forest and the rest quite flooded. But this year, the Pantanal is really dry. So the Paraguay River has never been this dry. It's 2 meters below what it should be. There's no navigation. Pantanal usually has a marked wet season and a marked dry season. But this year, yeah, the rains have simply not arrived. So we can see everything is bone dry, very, very dry. So there's a lot of dry matter, organic matter, and the humidity is very low. So it's very, very, very easy for the Pantanal to catch fire. And what people have to try to imagine is that this huge area, which is the Pantanal, there are no roads, so access is really difficult. So it's really hard to put out a fire once it started.
What kind of species live there?
Oh, the Pantanal is well known for the diversity of species that is found here. We have large populations of jaguars, giant otters, marsh deer, pampas deer, tapirs, giant anteaters. And my NGO in the Pantanal, we work with giant armadillos. And this is the place where there's healthy populations of giant armadillos.
It sounds as if these populations were already threatened by the lack of rain before the fires arrived. Would that be right?
No, the Pantanal has a high diversity of species, but not endemic species. And the animals here are used to these extreme fluctuations of flooded or dry. So the species would not be suffering too much. However, if the fires are anything like 2020, this can be really catastrophic for wildlife, but also for people.
Arnaud Desbier, president of the Wild Animal Conservation Institute in Brazil. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.